we've been searching for that time to get on some sort of a roll here to get that good feeling, and you need a game like this to give you a chance.
We're still struggling to try and score goals night in and night out, but we've been able to do that in the last couple games.
It doesn't get any easier as the season moves on. Road games get tougher and tougher.
There's not an easy answer to that.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Ezra, Dave, and Drew on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Crosby back, Schultz a shot, score! It's over, Rust is there, he scores! Kessel fed ball, he scores! The opportunity for Sherry, would not go, he scores! Mata across, Kessel there, Kessel a shot, he scores! And then Kessel. And then Malkin and Hicks, he scores!
It had been a best of three. The Penguins now one win away from hoisting the Stanley Cup for a second consecutive year after Thursday night's 6-0 defeat. Demolition, if you will, of the Nashville Predators. Game 6 of that series of the Stanley Cup Final goes tomorrow evening back in Nashville. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. And for all those listening live at TSN1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. If you use that social media tool and you want to message us on it, by all means, at Illegal Curve. You can also text us here in studio, 1290.90. Standard messaging rates do apply. Send us a text, 1290.90. And our website that's got the latest Winnipeg Jets news, not that there's a ton of it, but it's going to pick up very quickly now as we're into the final week of the Stanley Cup Final. That's illegalcurve.com. I say good morning to my colleagues, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk. Gentlemen, good to see you on this Saturday morning. Nice to see you both here.
Yeah, good morning, boys. Drew, I promise I'm not going to throw a water bottle at you.
I appreciate that. But are you going to throw it with your right hand or your left hand if you were going to throw it at me?
Probably the way I'm sitting, it would probably be the left hand, even though I'm right-handed, but so I'm not going to do it, so you have nothing to worry about.
Okay, it was a pretty poor throw there from Sid the Kid. Morning, Dave. I've seen you throw from right field many a day, many a time, and you know the laser that you have on you. I'd be concerned if you threw a water bottle at me from these close proximities.
You shouldn't be, because my throw would be much like Bryce Harper's, and it would be when he threw his helmet, and it would be completely. If I'm throwing it at you, it'd most likely go out the door. So. I don't think you have to worry about my arm.
Well, every now and then you've nailed a runner at third trying to advance, trying to take an extra little base on that arm of yours.
Blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while.
Attaboy. Gentlemen, we of course start with the Stanley Cup Final. Game 5 occurred on Thursday night. I believe Game 6 is scheduled for 3 weeks from now, if I'm not mistaken, given the scheduling of this series. But it was an absolute demolition by the Pittsburgh Penguins. They take a 3-2 lead.
I wonder if the former WWF tag team Demolition likes that reference, Drew.
I don't know. You think they're listening?
Maybe.
You never know. Maybe we're huge among former 1980s wrestling tag teams.
Yeah, maybe
Strike
we,
Force.
Yeah, and maybe we could get that going, right? Because you had the Legion of Doom line back in the 90s, right?
Sure. Maybe, you know, Legion of Doom, Demolition, everything along those lines. It's a possibility that's the case. I'll tell you what, the Penguins were a team on a mission in Game 5, and it really did look like after those two, I would describe, lackluster games in Nashville for the Penguins, that they just sort of flipped the switch. I'm not sure what happened or how. I mean, besides the fact that Pekka Rinne just looks like an absolute shell of himself when he's anywhere other than Bridgestone Arena. That was a tremendous performance by the Penguins and a disheartening performance by the Predators.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. And I actually thought Game 4 was a much better game for the Penguins. I thought that was maybe the best game of the first four games. And obviously they won the first two games, but you could make a strong argument that the Nashville Predators outplayed the Penguins in large chunks of those games in Pittsburgh. But it was those goals that came in small 3-minute spurts that really was the difference. And also Pekka Rinne just wasn't very good, right, Drew? But
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't really say it any other way, guys. Game 5 was a complete smashing of the Nashville Predators, and it starts really early, 1 minute into the game. Crosby gets in alone, hits the post, draws a penalty, and they score shortly after. And the real big storyline going into Game 5 was, how is Pittsburgh going to respond after losing the previous two games? Because we haven't seen that a lot in these playoffs. And then was Phil Kessel going to be able to get on the scoreboard because he had no goals in the first four games? And Pittsburgh couldn't buy a power play goal. And they get that power play goal really early. And for me, it wasn't even Phil Kessel's goal that was the most impressive. It was the assist that he had on Evgeny Malkin's goal that was the most impressive. Mm-hmm. I thought Phil Kessel was excellent in Game 5. And obviously, Sidney Crosby continued his strong play from Game 4 into Game 5. And I realized that, you know, the big story after the game was the water bottle, but come on, guys. I mean, the game was 4-0 at that point, and even aside from the score, I mean, so he throws the water bottle on the ice, so maybe he gets a 2-minute minor. I mean, the fact that this we're talking about this a day after Game 5 is ridiculous.
The water bottle to me was no big deal. I thought what was more of a big deal, or what more, I mean, it really did show, I think, how intense Crosby was in that game, was when he tried to pile drive PK Subban's head into the ice on a couple different occasions.
It was like 15 different occasions. It was continuous. But, you know, they clearly, I mean, there was interesting audio between the two of them going back and forth that was online that doesn't bear repeating on the radio, but it was quite evident that there's a healthy disdain during the playoffs, at least, as these two are competing for the ultimate goal. And, you know, you saw Sidney Crosby at his best yesterday, in Game 5. So I thought he put on a masterful performance. Matt Murray, his second shutout of the playoffs, made, I think, 24 saves. He was solid. Not, you know, didn't need to be spectacular, but made the saves that Pittsburgh needed him to make. And like, as he said, you know, Pittsburgh gets that early power play courtesy of Crosby, and then Justin Schultz gets that goal. So, I mean, that really kind of set the tone early. And it deflated, you know, because the one thing Nashville needed to do was, like, I'm not saying they probably needed to score the first goal to give them confidence in Pittsburgh, but they for sure needed to prevent any early goals. And you could sense right off the hop that it was going to be a long night for Nashville after that happens, you know, because the problem is, and I'm not saying Pittsburgh scored right away, obviously they didn't, but I think it was like, what, five minutes later that they got the Rust goal? I think something along those lines. So it was, you know what I mean? So the problem was it just kept coming and coming and coming. And, you know, at that point, with the way Pittsburgh's played in Pittsburgh and the way Nashville's played in Pittsburgh, probably more importantly, you knew it was going to be a long night for the Predators.
If you're the Predators, and so Game 6, of course, back at home, that's tomorrow evening, where Pekka Rinne has a .962 save percentage. He's been very good on home ice.
It's unbelievable.
And
.962, that's not just in one round. That's going on four rounds now.
No, sorry. In this series, he's got a .962 save percentage. I should have clarified that. Where he stopped 50 of 52 shots on home ice.
I don't think it's that far off for the playoffs.
No, he's been very good at home throughout the entire playoffs. Yep. You're right. But just in this series, just in the five games that have been played so far, the two at home, he's got a .962 save percentage. Contrast that to the three games he's been in Pittsburgh, where he currently has a .752 save percentage. If this goes seven games, and I think it's going to go seven games, I don't think the Predators are going to lose on home ice in front of their crowd.
Well, they've only lost once all playoffs. So.
Right. So it's sort of, you can make an argument for why it's a logical point I'm taking. How can you have any confidence, if you're the Predators, that Pekka Rinne is going to show up for a Game 7 in Pittsburgh?
Right, and obviously, like you said, you're assuming that, you know, Nashville wins Game 6, which I agree. I could see Nashville winning Game 6 just because they were so dominant in Games 3 and 4, right? Mm-hmm. So, especially Game 3. Look, at Pekka Rinne, it's been a Jekyll and Hyde situation, right, Drew? He's been excellent at home, and he was good on the road in the first three rounds, but you're facing the best offensive team in the league in Pittsburgh, right? So he struggled big time. And I was actually a little bit surprised that UC Saros went in early in the second. I thought that they might give Pekka Rinne maybe a little more leeway there in the second period. But at that point, you're down 3-0 to the Penguins at home. You know, Matt Murray most likely is not going to give up three goals, right? But I was just a little bit surprised in that. So I thought UC Saros, obviously, he goes in and you can't really fault him for letting in three goals at that point, as far as I'm concerned. The killer goal, guys, was the Malkin goal. The Malkin goal late in the first period was the killer, because even though Pittsburgh had dominated the play in the first period, 2-0 is a lot different than 3-0, right? We know that in hockey, right? So, you know, Pekka Rinne, I guess, you know, the first goal, the Schultz goal, it's a power play point shot. Is he screened a little bit? You maybe say he should have stopped that. Brian Rust's goal, really, it was defensive miscoverage by the Nashville Predators, which led to that goal, right? And it was a really nice pass by Chris Kunitz. You got to give Kunitz a really nice credit there for making that pass to Russ. And then he obviously makes a really nice move to his forehand, then backhand. And then the third goal, it's a nice shot by Evgeny Malkin. So really, of those three goals, maybe you fault him on one of those goals. But to get back to your question, Drew, I mean, yes, you know, going into Game 7, if there is a Game 7, he has not been good in PPG Paints Arena, right? So, I mean, you have to have confidence in him because he got you to this point. But as far as how he's played in this series, I don't have a lot of confidence in how he's going to play in that building because he hasn't been good.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the, you know, Peter Laviolette has been there before with Michael Layton when he was the goaltender for the Philadelphia Flyers in their cup run against the Blackhawks a few years ago. But it's almost the same situation. You have this goalie who played well on home ice, but when you take him out of the friendly confines of his home arena, he's an absolute atrocity.
Well, just on that topic, though, I mean, guys, like, was that Nashville crowd not one of the best crowds you've ever seen? I mean, give that crowd so much respect. And you know, you love the atmosphere there. It kind of almost reminds you of an NFL game, right? You have a lot of guys, fans dressed up in costumes and everything like that. So, I mean, the fans there are really electric. And you, even though you can't really quantify this, you got to think that those fans were giving Nashville just that extra little boost.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the atmosphere in Nashville has been absolutely tremendous. And now, we've seen a lot of games being played in Nashville because of the Jets and the Central Division rivals against them, but they've certainly taken it to a whole new level, and it's nice to see that they're getting the national attention that they deserve for being a tremendous fan base there in Music City. Now, I think that fan base is going to help propel the Predators to that seventh game. I expect that they're going to win tomorrow night. Now, granted, the Penguins have never won a cup in front of their own home crowd, so in keeping with tradition, it would be that they would win tomorrow night. But, and, you know, we'll see how that plays out in any event. But the way, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right, Ezzy, that the Predators deserve full marks for how their crowd has responded and how the team has responded for their crowd as well.
And having said that, guys, even though the home team has won every game in the series, you know damn well that Pittsburgh does not want that series going back to Pittsburgh. Even though, as you said, Drew, they'd like to give their fans, you know, a Stanley Cup win on home ice.
Mm-hmm.
You'd rather end it in 6 as opposed to 7, right? Why take that chance?
Sure, because in a one game, anything can happen. Maybe,
exactly.
You know, maybe Pekka Rinne becomes a Pekka Rinne that we're used to seeing or that we've seen on home ice as opposed to the shell of himself that we've seen while he's been playing in Pittsburgh. You're absolutely right there, Ez.
And Nashville's going to have to be a lot stronger in front of Pekka Rinne. I thought P.K. Subban, even though his possession numbers were actually decent, he was on for a couple of the goals 5-on-5 against Pittsburgh. And I thought one of the bigger differences between games 3 and 4 and game 5 is I thought Pittsburgh's defense looked a lot quicker. I thought guys like Ian Cole, Ron Hainsey looked really slow in games 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And even though Ron Hainsey isn't a guy that you expect to score a lot of goals, it was a beautiful goal that he scored. So I think Nashville's got to be a lot stronger defensively. Mike Fisher was burned pretty bad, too. I think that was the fourth goal in front of the net, if I'm not mistaken. Was that Connor Sheary's goal, the fourth goal?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Mike Fisher was kind of caught sleeping a little bit there in front of the net, and Mike Fisher's been sensational defensively. So I just thought Nashville kind of got off their game a little bit. But the way they played in games 3 and 4, if they play like that in game 6, I agree with you. It's going back to Pittsburgh.
Do you think, Dave, that P.K. Subban, you would never publicly admit it, do you think he should regret maybe poking the bear that is Sidney Crosby a little bit?
You know, that's so hard to say because, I mean, yeah, in theory, yes, because, you know, Crosby had 3 assists in game 5 and Pittsburgh won the game. So I guess you could say that it was an ill-advised play by P.K. Subban. But, you know, I mean, I don't know how serious you need to take that stuff. I don't know that he wasn't taking too much
liberties.
Liberty, yeah, exactly, with Sidney Crosby. Crosby just tried to maintain his focus. And I, you know, I mean, look, there are some people who could say that that's going to be a problem and that maybe that was a distraction. You know, I guess you could say that because, in fact, Pittsburgh won the game. Now, if Nashville wins the game, you know, maybe P.K. Subban looks brilliant for trying that sort of tactic and trying to get Sidney Crosby a little bit off his game. But, you know, Sidney Crosby is, by my definition, the greatest player in the game right now. And he's showing it in these playoffs, right? He's 1 point behind Malkin, same points per game, you know, throughout the playoffs as those two kind of are the co-leaders. And they've shown their way throughout the playoffs.
No, Dave, Sid for sure gave Subban a few extra shots behind the net. But in the third period, when Colton Sissons cross-checks Olli Maatta in the face, to me that's much worse and should have been a suspendable offense.
So you think he should have been suspended? The NHL came out early yesterday and said even though it's a match penalty and it's automatically reviewed for a suspension, the NHL said no additional discipline is necessary.
Well, you know,
is this the first?
No, I believe it was an automatic suspension, and they rescinded the automatic
suspension.
Well,
it's an automatic suspension pending a review.
Right, pending the review. Yeah.
He got a five-minute major on the play.
Yeah.
So it was obviously, you know, a big enough cross-check that it warranted a five-minute major, right? So, again, I mean, I like Colton Sissons' game. I think he's been very good. This has been his coming-out party in the 2016-17 playoffs. But, I mean, you cross-checked a guy in the face.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, and I don't think there's been any supplementary discipline. I don't think there's been any suspensions in these playoffs whatsoever. I can't think of a guy who's been suspended for a game in these playoffs, and I know suspensions have been down this season in general, and I know that suspensions in the playoffs are a little more rare than they are in the regular season, but I can't remember a playoffs where there's been absolutely no suspensions at all for on-ice conduct, and I don't think there's been any suspensions in this playoffs season. Which I think tells you something about NHL Department of Player Safety. They're letting a lot of things go, because if cross-checking a guy in the face doesn't draw a suspension, at this point in time, what will? I think it's, you can probably go around and slice a guy with your skate in Game 6, and you'll be fine for Game 7.
And, you know, on the other side of the coin, you could also say if, you know, slashing a guy on the glove and severing his finger doesn't get you a suspension.
Absolutely.
Right? Crosby, my thought.
Yeah, regular season, though, so maybe there's a difference. But even then, who knows what the NHL and the Department of Player Safety have been up to. In any event, Game 6 between the Preds and the Penguins, that goes tomorrow night. When we come back, we discuss the Stanley Cup Final, more so in the, rather than going into detail about this series, but is it the least entertaining part of the playoffs? Is the Stanley Cup Final a letdown after the three rounds that precede it? We'll talk about that next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Other than game one, there really hasn't been any suspense.
Mm-hmm,
you know, like, what's going to happen here? How's the team going to adjust? You know, it just seems that the game's got going in one direction and the other team hasn't been able to turn it around. You don't want that, I don't think. I think as a entertainment, you want to see more of that back and forth, to Jamie's point. You want to see the lead changes. But again, once one team's got the edge here, the other team they haven't shown any capability of turning it around. They just haven't.
Margins of victory in the first five games of the Stanley Cup Final. 2 goals, 3 goals, 4 goals, 3 goals, 6 goals. Has not yet been a close game in this 2017 Stanley Cup Finals. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. Question for you gentlemen, as I previewed before the break, is coming back. Is the Stanley Cup Final, and I don't, you know, recently, let's say take the last 5 years, has the Stanley Cup Final been almost a letdown after the earlier rounds of the playoffs? Has this, you know, captured the attention of the average sporting public, or is this something that's just happening and doesn't really, you know, you watch it if you're home and you watch it if it's a lousy day and you're not going outside? You know, does the NHL need to do something to make the Stanley Cup Final itself more captivating?
Yeah, it's a good question. Game, you know, you said there haven't been any close games, but game one was tied, and then you had the goal that was scored by Gensel late in the third. So I would say game one was close.
Okay.
And then game four, you also had an empty netter, and it was 3-1. Arvidsson scored the goal late in the second. So I would say two of the five games have been close. Not just the final score, but I'm talking about the play on the ice. But I agree with you. I mean, certainly games...
Has it been compelling play on the ice, though?
Well, I mean, you have Nashville in the playoffs. Pardon, not the playoffs. You have Nashville in the Stanley Cup Final for the first time. So to me, right there, that's compelling. Nashville has been an amazing story. You have the storyline of Pittsburgh trying to repeat for the first time since 1997, 1998. That's a storyline. You have two American-born coaches for the first time in the Stanley Cup Final. That's a storyline. But your question, though, Drew, I mean, let's be honest. you're never going to duplicate the first round, right? The first round is the most exciting every year. I think we'd all agree about that. But the second round this year, I thought, was almost just as exciting. You know, you had Anaheim and Edmonton, I thought, was the best series. Obviously, in the first round, you had Washington, Toronto was arguably the best series. But so when you think about that, it's almost like a reverse pyramid, right?
Mm-hmm.
With the Stanley Cup final, you know, being the least exciting. But for me, and again, this, I'm a hardcore hockey fan, so for your average hockey fan, it's a little bit different. But for me, every year the Stanley Cup final is exciting no matter who's in it, because that's what you play the entire season for, right? To see who's going to win the Stanley Cup. But the actual series, I would say this series has been exciting at times and not exciting at times. When you went back to Nashville for games 3 and 4 with Nashville down 2-0, and it looked like, you know, this series could be over in 4 or 5 games, I thought the atmosphere in Nashville with the live music, the country music and all of that, I thought it kind of re-energized the series. And then obviously Nashville wins game 3 and then they tie it up in game 4. So we have a series here. But as far as the in-game excitement goes, maybe at times it's been lacking. I would say game 1 and game 4 were probably the best games on the ice. And then obviously for if you're a Pittsburgh fan, game 5 was the best, right?
Let me ask you, Dave.
But when you talk about, you know, previous years and everything like that, we can go back and we could pick exciting series. You go back and Chicago, LA in 2014.
That wasn't the Cup final, though.
No. But I'm saying you could go back to rounds that weren't the Stanley Cup finals, mm-hmm. and you could say there were great series in the first round, second round, and third round. Usually, Stanley Cup final is 6 games. You rarely see a Stanley Cup final go to 7 games. So right off the bat, you knew that this series, the likelihood of this series going to 7 games was not as high as earlier rounds, because you go back Pittsburgh, San Jose last year, that was 6 games. You go back the previous year, Chicago, Tampa, that was 6 games. Mm-hmm. I think actually the last 4 or 5 years, if I'm not mistaken, have been 6 games, right?
No, except for LA and New York was 5.
Right. So there you go. And so you knew that the likelihood of it going to 7, but do we really determine how exciting a series is based on how many games it goes to?
No, I don't think the game, how many games it goes to, is necessarily dictates if a series is exciting. But in terms of memorable series, when was the last time we had what I would describe as a really, you know who wins the cup and you remember who wins the cup, but when was the last Stanley Cup final that was quote unquote memorable?
2011, I think, Boston and Vancouver, 7-game series. You know, Vancouver's got the lead. You think that they're going to win the Stanley Cup for the first time, and since, you know, 93, bringing it back to Canada, as so many people have talked about.
And then they choke on
home
ice.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, you know, the fact that it was a 7-game series, the fact that, you know, it looked like the Canucks were going to win the Stanley Cup for the first time in their franchise history, you know, there was a lot of excitement there. I mean, I don't know how many people want to cheer for the Canucks, but just the idea of the, you know, like I said, the Cup coming back to Canada. There was a lot of excitement for that series. And again, there was a lot of blood, you know, and there were a lot of storylines. You had Milan Lucic, everything going on with him, BC boy, and you know, Tim Thomas and his kind of foibles and his interesting quirks. So you had a lot of
you had different, a riot after game 7. I mean,
you had a riot after game 7. Well, that definitely made it memorable, not in a good way, but that definitely made it memorable. But in terms of like the on-ice hockey product, I thought that series was kind of like a knock 'em out, drag 'em out sort of one that really kind of stuck in my head. If you're asking me for, you know, the last, you know, half dozen years, then that would be the one that kind of sticks out for me.
I would agree. And that the problem with that is that's now been almost 6 consecutive seasons where the finals have been blah, you know, for lack of a better word. That they've been, you know, yeah, you've watched them and yeah, you remember them in bits and pieces, but there's nothing that's been especially compelling about them. And I think that's a problem for the NHL. Now, maybe it's a function of the West was so dominant for so many years in a row there when they were bouncing back and forth between the Kings and the Blackhawks. You know, those 4 straight years where either the Kings or the Blackhawks won. You know, the Penguins and the Sharks last year was interesting because you got to see Crosby win the Cup again, but it wasn't what I would describe as memorable. You're not going to go back and think about what a great series that was.
Well, you also had San Jose in the Cup final for the first time. You had guys like Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau, longtime NHLers, trying to win their first Stanley Cup.
It had stories. I mean, and there were storylines to it, because every Cup has storylines to it, but nothing that I would describe as, you know, you're going to remember back 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, the Pittsburgh-Detroit back-to-back, that was, those are memorable series.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
no question.
Because it was almost evenly matched teams having great games, where, we haven't seen what I would describe as a great Stanley Cup final game for a lot of years now.
I would agree with you that the last 2 years especially have not had the best Stanley Cup finals, but Dave mentioned 2011. Boston-Vancouver was a classic series. I would go even back the year before and even 2 years before that. 2010, you had Chicago winning the first Stanley Cup. That team was unbelievable. That was their first of three Stanley Cups, right? Beating Philadelphia, Patrick Kane getting that overtime goal. Yeah. And then 2009, obviously, with Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, Pittsburgh winning their first Stanley Cup since the early 90s, the year after Detroit won the Stanley Cup. Then they faced them again. So I would say, Drew,
but
that
it's
yes.
Been almost a de- it's been close to a decade then. I mean, that's the problem is the last, I mean.
Well, no, I would say we just said
2011.
2011.
You know, that's 5, 6 years ago now.
I mean, even you go back to 2015, right? The Blackhawks won their first cup in 77 years on home ice. They defeated Tampa Bay.
Do you remember anything about those games?
Well, I thought it was a good series.
Do you remember any, is there anything about those games? I mean, the Boston-Vancouver series, there's, I mean, plays in that series that are almost indelible in your memory when, you know, they were using one of the Sedins as a punching bag and, you know, as a speed bag. He was getting jabbed in the face in front of the net. And you remember that. And nobody from Vancouver fought back. You don't remember anything from that. I don't remember any moments from that Chicago-Tampa Bay series a couple years ago. It just was a series that happened. Chicago won, and
I think from the NHL's perspective, they're probably happy with the teams that have been in it because they're all major market cities, especially from the West, not necessarily from the East. But, you know, I mean, when you have the Rangers in it, you know, that's a good thing. San Jose, probably a good thing. Boston, for sure. You know, I'm talking about San Jose's not a team from the East, obviously. But the Devils kind of surprising everyone and getting in there that year. So, I mean, like, they've been happy with the markets. And, you know, look at Nashville. Look what Nashville's, you know, kind of driven in terms of a TV rating. Yeah. They're massive. They've been huge. So from a perspective of the NHL, I know what you're saying, Drew. Like, the games aren't the best, but it's hard because, you know, generally these teams don't have the hate on that they do for teams that they play, you know, in their conference, in their division all the time. So as a result of that, you don't have that same sort of, you know, disdain or dislike for the teams. And obviously you're challenging for the Stanley Cup and you've been playing, you know, all season long for it. So there's going to be a more recent, you know, a more, the hate will come, but it's not the same thing as when like LA plays Chicago or, you know, two teams that face each other 5-6 times during the regular season.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're thrust into a first round series against each other. That's when you see it kind of spill over because you may have just played each other the week before. You know, so I think that's why it's more likely these first round series are better.
All right, one point of clarification before we go to break. We're going to bring in Adam Vingan, who covers the Predators for the Tennessean. Matt Calvert was suspended in the first round for cross-checking Tom Kunackle. So that's been the only supplementary discipline thus far in the playoffs.
Good Brandon boy.
There you go. When we come back, as I mentioned, Adam Vingan will talk to us about the Predators as we head into Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour here on TSN 1290. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us in studio by texting us at 1290. We were talking about the Department of Player Safety earlier. Here comes a text that says, NHL's Department of Player Safety is run by the cast of Goon. Are you really surprised? A nice text coming in at 1290. You can reach us here in studio. Standard messaging rates do apply.
Great movie.
A great movie indeed. And, of course, our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, Adam Vingan joins us. Adam covers the Predators for that fine broadsheet. Adam, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure, Adam. Obviously, Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final goes tomorrow evening back in Music City, where the atmosphere will be raucous, as we all expect. Coming off of that Game 5 performance, where the Predators got absolutely blown out in Pittsburgh, do you think it's going to be difficult for the Predators to bounce back from that defeat, or have they just wiped the slate clean and say, we're moving on to Game 6, and then hopefully a winner-take-all Game 7?
Well, I remember Peter Laviolette saying after that game, which was a 6-0 loss, he didn't necessarily want guys to just walk out of PPG Paints Arena and completely forget about it. I think he wanted it to sit with them at least overnight. And you could tell talking to them yesterday, they didn't practice, but several players spoke: Colin Wilson, Yannick Weber, Matthias Ekholm, Victor Arvidsson. They were salty. I mean, they weren't saying anything, but it was the way that they were saying it. They were a little pissed off yesterday, and I could certainly tell, and they should be, because they were flat out embarrassed in Game 5. Now, you look at the scores of the games up through this portion of the Stanley Cup Final, and they're all fairly, you know, high scoring, and there's multiple goal deficits near the end. But I feel like the scores throughout the Stanley Cup Final up until this past game were a little bit misleading. This game was the score of that game, 6-0, was indicative of what happened in that game. The Penguins from the opening shift were the better team. You saw when Sidney Crosby split Roman Josi and Ryan Ellis to draw a penalty, then set up Justin Schultz for the power play goal. The Predators were never in that game. I think I tweeted something to the effect of that Sidney Crosby was playing in expert mode and the Predators were a notch above disconnected controller. I mean, that's about how it looked on the ice the other night in Pittsburgh. If you're looking for any sort of silver lining, there are a couple things. One, the Predators are 9-1 at home. And they will play their final home game, regardless of the outcome, tomorrow night at Bridgestone Arena. Two, that was the fourth loss of the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs, with a goal differential of 6 or more goals. And the three previous teams to lose by 6 or more each rebounded to win the next game, including Ottawa against Pittsburgh in Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Final. After they lost 7-0 in Pittsburgh, they went on to win in Game 6, and Ottawa to force in Game 7. And the Predators have also only lost consecutive games once this postseason, but it was at the start of the series against Pittsburgh by losing Games 1 and 2 on the road. So there's a lot to say, well, the Predators are in a good position to bounce back. I'm not so certain that they're going to, just because based on the way the Penguins dissected them the other night.
Adam, why do you think Pekka Rinne has struggled so much on the road in the Stanley Cup Final? And were you surprised that UC Saros replaced him to start the second period of Game 5?
A little bit surprised. I think the thing that may have stopped me from being completely surprised was that when they were trailing 3-0 at the end of the first period in Game 1, a lot of those goals that the Penguins scored in that situation were, I think, you could attribute to bad puck luck. So I understood the Predators going back to Rinne in Game 1. I wouldn't say that was the same case in Game 5. I thought, just as I said before, the Predators were thoroughly outclassed, especially in that first period. And, you know, why subject Pekka Rinne to that anymore? If the Predators are to win Game 6, there's going to be 2 more days off between Game 6 and 7 on Monday and Tuesday before the game on Wednesday. And there's going to be a lot of talk, and I'm sure it's going to come from myself too, about Pekka Rinne's play in Pittsburgh. I don't know exactly why he plays like that there. I mean, you think it's an anomaly, but I don't know if it really is. But I'm not sure if there's any sort of environmental thing that you can point to say this is why Pekka Rinne can't win in Pittsburgh. But what I can tell you is that Pekka Rinne, if he were to go back to Pittsburgh with the team, of course he would, but if the team were to go back to Pittsburgh for Game 7, Pekka Rinne has the worst road save percentage in a Stanley Cup final in the expansion era, with just a shade over 75%. I mean, he's going to start Game 7, there's no doubt about it. But if you're a Predators fan, I wouldn't feel very comfortable about that situation. The Predators are going to have a very tough time, even if they win Game 6, to win Game 7, just because, for whatever reason, their starting goaltender, who's been spectacular at home all postseason long and very good in the postseason overall in general, can't stop a beach ball when the game is played in Pittsburgh.
Adam, regardless of the outcome from Sunday's game, what impact will this deep playoff run have on the team and the city of Nashville?
Well, I think you're already seeing it, just because you're looking at what's been going on outside the arena. I mean, it's more than 50,000 people, according to the National Police Department, showed up outside of Bridgestone Arena before Game 3. I think what this will do for the organization in terms of its fan reach is this. I mean, there's always been an undercurrent, for lack of a better term, of fan support of this team in this city. I know that a lot of people watching from afar who are not familiar with the Predators, who may be getting their first taste of Nashville as a hockey town in this playoff run or even in this Stanley Cup final, may just say, well, they're in the Stanley Cup final and Nashville's a big event town, so that's why people are starting to care. That could not be further from the truth. This team sold out all 41 of its home games for the first time this regular season, and it sold out, of course, every game this postseason. And they've always had a very hardcore, diehard fan base, but it's been a smaller group. The way I like to talk about it is that the people that are in the building every night are essentially that diehard fan base. I think you're going to start to see a lot more people who may have only watched the team on a casual basis follow this team a lot more often within Nashville. I think that is something that is certainly going to happen. As for the organization, isn't this what we expected them to do at the beginning of the season? I mean, that's the funny thing about expectations, is if you base your perception of the Predators on expectations that were set during the preseason, they're exactly where they're supposed to be. If you set expectations based on how they played during the regular season, when they were the last team and, by record, the worst team to make the Stanley Cup playoffs, they're exceeding expectations. But this team is set up to compete like this for several more years. They're young. They've got great contracts that are good for the salary cap, so that they can accentuate their roster more if they need to. There's a lot to like. At the end of the day, look at where this team is. They're two wins from a Stanley Cup final, and they've been playing, for the past 6-7 games without their number one center. They lost their most dynamic rookie in the first game of the second round to a broken leg. They're sort of putting together a makeshift roster that could ultimately win the Stanley Cup. So it says a lot to their drafting and development and just all of that, that this team is going to be positioned to compete like this for a long time.
Adam Vingan is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Adam covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper. Adam, I wouldn't expect him to ever say so publicly, but do you think that P.K. Subban has any regrets maybe about poking the bear that is Sidney Crosby?
No, because this is what he is supposed to be doing. And I wrote it in an article for the Tennessean Today, and I didn't say it at the time, and I'm comfortable saying it now. The fact that the bad breath thing, the Listerine thing, took on a life of its own and, amongst people of my ilk in the Stanley Cup final, I thought was silly. That's a nice way to put it. And if you watch the Showtime show, the all-access question of the Stanley Cup, you can hear exactly what the two of them say after Game 3. It has nothing to do with mouthwash. I think the most important thing that was said about this rivalry came all the way back in Game 2 before we even thought about bad breath, where P.K. Subban said in the locker room, to paraphrase, after they lost Game 2, every single time Sidney Crosby's going to be on the ice, I'm going to be in his face, and he's not going to like it. That to me speaks more volumes than anything else that anybody has said regarding that in this series. And I think the Predators, I don't even look at it as P.K. Subban. I look at it as the Predators as a whole. Here's something that would concern me if I'm Nashville. Entering Game 5, Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, and Phil Kessel had combined for 7 total points among the three of them. At the end of the second period in Game 5, in that game alone, those three combined for 8 points. If I'm Nashville, that scares the living daylights out of me, because there's nobody on the Predators, or really anywhere in the NHL, in my opinion, that can finish better than Crosby, Malkin, and Kessel when the three of them are playing well. If those three come out and play like they did in Game 5 and Game 6, you can shine up the Stanley Cup before the game is over for the Pittsburgh Penguins. So they have to do a much better job, the Predators do, of stopping those three. Because it's not even just that. It's from a team defense standpoint as well. The Predators' defense, which was very tight and good in Games 1 through 3, has been porous in Games 4 and 5. They've allowed too many scoring chances. They're getting beat. The Penguins are doing everything right to create offense, and the Predators have not done a good enough job to stop them. You know, this series has, you know, this series is shifted in Pittsburgh's favor right now. So I'm not saying it's because PK Subban decided to question, try to needle Sidney Crosby because that's what he's supposed to do. But if I'm the Predators, I do everything in my power to make sure that Sid doesn't have the puck for long periods of time in Game 6, because if he does, it's not going to work out well for them.
Adam, you mentioned Finnish, and combined, Philip Forsberg, James Neal, and Victor Arvidsson have three goals. Do the Predators have any chance of winning the Stanley Cup if those three players don't start scoring a little bit more?
No. I mean, the next two games, the next game definitely tomorrow, and if you're in the Predators, hopefully a game 7 on Wednesday, and you need your big guns to step up. And as I mentioned before, they've gotten this far without Ryan Johansson. When they lost Ryan Johansson, they were tied at 2 in the Western Conference Final against Anaheim. I thought they were done because I didn't think that they could win. I mean, I thought they could get out of that series, but I didn't think they had a chance against Pittsburgh if they didn't have Ryan Johansson, and I was wrong. But with respect to players who have stepped up tremendously, like Colton Sissons and Pontus Åberg and Frederick Boudreau, those three aren't going to win you a Stanley Cup. You need Victor Arvidsson. You need Philip Forsberg. You need James Neal. You need PK Subban. You need Mike Fisher. You need the players that can play in big-time moments to make those plays. And they haven't really done it yet to an extended degree, and they've been able to get by without it. But they're not going to win a championship without those contributions. The Penguin stars, between games 4 and 5, all the talk was about, where's Malkin? Where's Kessel? Well, they showed up. They had 5 combined points the other night. Now you sort of need the Predators' counterparts to do the same. You know, where's Philip Forsberg? Where's Victor Arvidsson? Where's James Neal? You need those three to step up, and if they don't, they're not going to like what happens.
Adam, we've talked about the party atmosphere in Nashville, and I read somewhere that they expect 70,000 for Sunday night outside the arena, and you have the conclusion, I believe, of the CMA Music Festival as well that evening in downtown Nashville. So just how insane is it going to be there to be in that sort of atmosphere outside the arena, number one? And is there any part of you that says this is what Nashville's been all along? Why, like, you know, almost a little bit of umbrage, like, why are people just taking notice now? Not necessarily from you, but from folks that are there and have been supporting this team from the outset?
Yeah, I think that if you were to talk to members of the Predators fan base, they're certainly excited and pleased that people are taking notice of what they're doing. But it has reached a point where those same fans are starting to roll their eyes. Because every single series has been, oh, look at Nashville. Look how great Nashville is. They're really supporting hockey. They're doing such a great job. Remember when they almost moved 10 years ago? They're getting tired of it. Because this team has been playing very well, and their fan base has been supporting them. This is not a new thing. This is not, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is not, you know, the city of Nashville glomming on to a big event like they would a country music festival or something like that. I mean, this is Nashville being able to be focused on as a hockey market. Now, it also, those were the same stories that were written last January during the All-Star game. But now you at least have the Predators at the forefront of it, and not necessarily the league at large and people coming out to see the best stars in the NHL. Am I tired of it? You know, I find it charming and a little endearing that people are catching on. I mean, I've lived this every day for the past 2.5 years. I mean, I remember how pleasantly surprised and awed I was when I moved here to cover this team and covered a game at Bridgestone Arena for the first time, which was in March of 2015. But, I mean, this is what I expected. And, yes, there are going to be even more than the Game 3 crowd outside of Bridgestone tomorrow because, as you mentioned, it is the conclusion of the CMA Fest, the annual country music festival, as well as Game 6. Now, there's not going to be a Stanley Cup party thrown in Nashville that night, if you're a Predators fan, at least. I mean, there could. I mean, the Penguins might win it. But, the idea before Game 5 of all of those people, this rowdy mixture of CMA Fest attendees and hockey fans coming together and the Predators possibly winning the Stanley Cup in front of all of them, just, you know, I can't think of a bigger party in the history of the city. But that's not going to happen. But, you know, I would say that overall, I think the fans here are happy that people are finally taking a good, hard look at them. But I think they're also slightly insulted that people are maybe portraying it as, you know, look at this diamond in the rough that we found, because they've been here. This is not new to them, and they don't want this, but at least with how this playoff run is going, it won't be new to anybody anymore.
Adam Vingan covers the Nashville Predators for the Tennessean newspaper. Game 6 of the Predators and the Penguins goes tomorrow evening. Adam, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care, Adam. Thanks again. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, a little bit of expansion draft discussion as the deadline for asking a player to waive their no-move clause is this coming Monday. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's an IC Saturday on TSN 1290.
TSN1290.ca.
Big thanks to Adam Vingan for joining us to discuss the Stanley Cup Final. In case you missed any of that interview, in case you missed any of the show, we'll have it available for download for you at the conclusion of the program. You can just subscribe to the show on iTunes or via Google Play. Get it sent to your Apple and or Android device each and every week. Make it simple. Get the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your device so you can listen when you want to. This segment of the show brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Gentlemen, Monday, as in, you know, 2 days from now, give or take, that is the deadline at 5 p.m. Eastern for a team to request that a player waive his no-move clause for purposes of the expansion draft. So, hypothetically, if the Jets were to ask or wanted to ask Toby Enstrom to waive his no-move clause, they have to do so by Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. Furthermore, next Friday, so June 16th, 6 days from now, that is the deadline for a player to agree to waive their no-move clause for purposes of the expansion draft. So basically what I'm saying is things are beginning, or in the next week or so, will become to get a little more clear as to what the Jets' plans are with regard to the expansion draft. Now, that being said, I asked the Jets, you know, if you request that Toby Enstrom waive his no-move clause, is that something that you will make available to the, you know, to the public, that inform the public about that? They said, no, there's no expectation that they will do so prior to the public release of their list of players that have been protected and unprotected. So we've discussed whether or not the Jets are going to do that with Toby Enstrom, you know, ad nauseum, I think, at this point in time. And thankfully, we're rapidly approaching the end of the discussion on the expansion draft. The question I have for you guys, though, we know the Jets are going to lose a player. We don't yet know who that player is going to be. But should the Jets try to provide incentive to the Golden Knights to leave some of their unprotected players alone and instead, you know, take one individual player that the Jets recommend, and for doing so, the Jets will throw them an extra draft pick or something along those lines. I.e., if Perreault or Lowry or Armia are left unprotected and the Jets want those players to not be selected, should the Jets throw the Golden Knights a draft pick in exchange for taking a guy like Marco Dano, let's say, instead of a guy like Adam Lowry or a guy like Matthew Perreault?
And you're talking about draft picks, obviously.
Yeah,
right?
I'm saying we'll give you a second-round pick so that you don't take Adam Lowry, or we'll give you a second-round pick so that you take Marco Dano instead of Matthew Perreault. Something like that, so that they sort of can protect other players, but it costs them something like a draft pick instead.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a weaker draft, so maybe a second-round pick doesn't mean as much as it did, but, you know, giving up a second-round pick to not take a player, most likely a forward, Drew, I think might be a little bit high of a cost to pay.
Sure. So I mean, it could be a third-round pick.
Sure,
also.
I'd be more comfortable with a fourth or fifth rounder, to be honest with you. But, I mean, you're definitely going to see those types of moves. As far as it goes with the Jets, I mean, Toby Enstrom is the name that we've heard bandied about for the last couple of months since the season ended, right, Drew?
Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, whether he waives his no-move clause, because if he does waive his no-move clause, not only could they expose him in the expansion draft, they could also trade him, right? Sure. So when you're talking about other players around the league, Marc-Andre Fleury is another one of those players that we're watching to see if he does waive his no-move clause to either get selected by Vegas or possibly traded to a team like Calgary. We had Aaron Portsline on last week. Scott Hartnell is another player that could potentially waive his no-move clause. He has a lot of years left and makes quite a bit of money, so he's another guy to look out for. But when it gets to the Jets, I mean, we don't know at this point. And you mentioned the Jets aren't going to tell us before the NHL expansion draft, and that is because there could be trade implications, right? So you don't want to necessarily reveal that. But, I mean, I've said all along, I have no idea if Toby Enstrom is willing to waive his no-move clause. It's been talked about a lot on the station. It's all speculation at this point. But it certainly would make Kevin Cheveldayoff and the management's job a lot easier, because then now you don't have to necessarily protect four defensemen. Right. You know you're going to protect Buff. You know you're going to protect Trouba. I think they're going to protect Myers, even though Myers has the injury concerns. I can't see them exposing Tyler Myers there. It leaves a big hole on the right side. So, I mean, Toby Enstrom, Drew, is the big wild card, if you want to call it that. But, I mean, sure, if you really don't want to lose a forward, and I've said all along, I think the fourth forward that they're going to protect, if they do go with option two, is Adam Lowry. I sound like a broken record. I feel like I've been saying that for 6 months, but I mean, Matthew Perreault is an excellent...
It's probably been closer to a year, to be honest.
Well, Perreault's an excellent player, but he's got more term, more years, and I think Adam Lowry is a foundation piece. I think 2 or 3 years from now, when the Jets are in the playoffs, because I believe they will be, I think most of us do, and you have players like Patrick Laine, Nikolaj Ehlers, Scheifele leading the offensive charge, Adam Lowry fits in perfectly as that third-line center. So I don't think they want to lose Lowry, and as far as losing Perreault, I mean, like you said, they have to lose someone. So whether that's Joel Armia, whether that's Andrew Kopp, whether it's Matthew Perreault, you have to lose someone. And I don't know necessarily that they trade a pick to Vegas in order to avoid losing a guy like Kopp or Armia.
It's so hard to know what the trade market is, because we really don't have a basis for it. Is it a third-round pick? Is it a second-round pick? Is it a fourth-round pick? We don't know. So, I mean, yeah, I agree with Ezra. You don't want to be giving away, like, your high draft picks willy-nilly. It's not like the Jets have, you know, a tremendous amount. They only have one of each, except until the seventh round this year. Mm-hmm. And then next year they have one of each until the fifth round. So, really, you don't have – if you want to give away one of those high picks to have a protection – then that's fine. But I suspect that, you know, George McPhee in Vegas is really setting up probably a high mark for, you know, what saying, okay, well, you can give me a pick, but it's going to have to be this pick for me not to take player X. And you know, I agree that they, like, look, there's no doubt in my mind, Jets coach Paul Maurice loves Adam Lowry. He loves Adam Lowry. Talks about Adam Lowry all the time. Talks about the type of player he is. They love the size of Adam Lowry. Now, to me, Matthew Perreault is an interesting case because, I mean, his contract kicks in, his new contract, well, new in that he signed it last year.
But it kicks in on July 1st.
Right. So the irony is that you've got a guy who you signed for in terms of a long-term deal about to kick in, and you've given him assurances. When we talk to Matthew Perreault at the end of the season scrums, Matthew Perreault talked about the fact that you know, he was kind of assured that he wouldn't be exposed or wouldn't be dealt. So, I mean, I have to think that Matthew Perreault thinks he's going to, and of course the team can say whatever they want, but, you know, you've got to, it's such a tough call in that regard. So I would probably trade a higher pick to protect Perreault, because it's all well and good to have a draft pick, but, you know, you have a known asset in Matthew Perreault. I think he's extremely critical for this team to provide scoring and the things he does. So I wouldn't be so quick to get rid of a player like Matthew Perreault.
Yeah, but the problem I have as well with protecting Matthew Perreault under option two, I think if you're going to protect three defensemen, then you protect Matthew Perreault. But when you have Brian Little, who's going to be re-signed to another contract, and then you have eventually Nikolaj Ehlers getting his second contract, and then you're playing Matthew Perreault, who's probably a couple of years from now, if he remains on the Jets, going to be a third-line guy, because you have Kyle Connor, Jack Roslovic, those types of players. I think you can afford to lose Perreault more than you can afford to lose Lowry.
Well, we will find out in the next couple of weeks how the expansion draft plays out. When we come back, Nick Henry is from Portage la Prairie, Manitoba. He played for the Regina Pats. He's expected to go in the first couple rounds of the upcoming NHL draft. We are joined by Nick coming up next to talk about his experience and the preview of upcoming NHL draft. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Hoping to hear from Nick Henry of the Regina Pats. He's, of course, from Portage La Prairie, going to be drafted, expected to be drafted, at least, in the upcoming 2017 NHL Draft. Hopefully, we'll hear from him coming up in this hour. Should make mention that this segment of the show, it's brought to you by Bell Acres Golf and Country Club, official golf course of Illegal Curve Hockey. Bell Acres offers an 18-hole championship golf course that golfers of all levels can enjoy. For more information or to book a tee time today, visit bellacres.com. Right now, send us a text. Text Bell Acres, BELACRES, to 129090. Again, Bell Acres to 129090. Standard messaging rates apply, and we'll give you a couple passes to get out to Bell Acres Golf and Country Club. One more time, Bell Acres, text that to 129090, and we'll pick a winner this hour that's going to go to Bell Acres and play a round of golf over there. The NHL hot stove is heating up as we get closer to the end of the Stanley Cup final and closer to what we expect to be a fairly chaotic time between now and the NHL draft and a little bit even after the NHL draft. The guys at Insider Trading have provided us a bit of an update. We'll talk about that next. Here's the Insider Trading boys.
A lot of action expected before and after the NHL expansion draft, and all eyes on Anaheim and a lot of salivating towards their depth on D. How do they approach this?
Well, I know a lot of people are looking at the Ducks ahead of the expansion draft and feeling like maybe there's a gun to their head. I'm not sure that's how they view it because, frankly, they're in a great position when you consider how many teams in the NHL are in dire need of an upgrade on D, and they happen to have one that they possibly can move. I think it's going to be Sammy Vatanen. I'm told teams are absolutely lining up in their interest for him. Among the teams that I think have interest, Toronto, Tampa Bay, New Jersey, but honestly, there are more teams than that. So if the Ducks move ahead on a trade for Sammy Vatanen, it allows them, I think, to protect all the guys they really want to, including Josh Manson. A lot of people wondering how they could protect him. Maybe he'll be left unprotected. No way. He'll be an Anaheim Duck through that process.
Well, and as we talked about last Friday, developing interest in Edmonton's Jordan Eberle, that should come as a surprise to no one. I know that the New York Islanders are in that group of teams that are interested, and because of the fact that they're going to have to, or it seems likely they're going to move a defenseman, maybe you can connect Travis Hamonic to the Edmonton Oilers. But know this, you know, Jordan Eberle is second only to Connor McDavid in terms of puck touches on the Edmonton Oilers. So the Oilers value him, and they're not going to give him away. Is there a strong chance he gets traded? Yes, there's a strong chance, but there's no guarantee.
Trade wins in Arizona as well. The Coyotes listening on veteran goalie Mike Smith. He's 34 years old. He's got a couple more years on his deal. I think they'd probably like to get younger at that position. If the offer is right, they're not going out of their way to try and deal this guy, but there is interest. I'm told there's at least three teams that have solicited phone calls to Arizona. Among the teams, Calgary, of course. We know they need an upgrading goal. I still think at the end of the day, the Flames' number one target is Marc-Andre Fleury, if at all possible. We'll find out after the Cup final, but certainly Mike Smith is a guy that I believe is at least on the back burner for Calgary as well.
We know San Jose loves Martin Jones. Are they close to an extension then?
I think all signs point towards an extension announced in early July. Very positive contract talks. He's a year out from free agency, but they're taking care of him this summer in a hurry.
That's the guys at Insider Trading, the TSN Hockey Insiders, giving us an update on where things stand for the hot stove season of the NHL. Sammy Vatanen, Jonas Brodin, a couple guys they mentioned right up at the top of the list. Evander Kane, formerly, of course, here of the Jets, now with Buffalo. He's rumored to be heading somewhere on the West Coast. A lot of teams supposedly interested. LA Kings, a team desperately in need of goal scoring. They seem like they would be a good fit for a guy like Evander Kane there, Ezzy. And then I think Sammy Vatanen, you know, he's been bandied about because we know the Ducks have that glut of defensemen that they have to somehow figure out how they're going to, you know, free up that logjam ahead of the NHL expansion draft.
Yeah, I guess starting with Sammy Vatanen, we talked about it a little bit last week, Drew. He's going to be out for half of the season next year, right?
Sure.
So even though the Anaheim Ducks are desperate to move a defenseman because they're going to re-sign Cam Fowler eventually, Sammy Vatanen, you know, isn't going to be able to step right into your lineup, right, even though he is a very valuable player. So even though the trade market appears as full of teams, it's going to be interesting to see what a team gives up, knowing that they're not going to be able to use him for the first 20 to 40 games of the season, right? Mm-hmm. Evander Kane is a very interesting one to me, guys, because Evander Kane is coming off a pretty decent year with the Buffalo Sabres. He's got 1 year left on his contract, and then he becomes a UFA, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the LA Kings going to give up to get a guy like Evander Kane? They probably would want to have some certainty that he's going to re-sign in L.A., right? But you mentioned the biggest problem the L.A. Kings had last year, one of the reasons why they didn't make the playoffs, the major reason why they didn't make the playoffs is they couldn't score. Defense was still pretty good, and the goaltending was good, whether it was Jonathan Quick, whether it was Peter Budaj, or even whether it was Ben Bishop towards the end of the year, right? So I feel like there are going to be multiple teams interested in Kane. He's always been linked to the Vancouver Canucks because he's from Vancouver, mm-hmm. used to play for the Vancouver Giants, but L.A. does seem like a good fit there. I think L.A. knows that they're not going to be a Stanley Cup contender next year. I'm not saying that they don't think they can get back into the playoffs, but if you do add a guy like Kane, your chances of getting back into the playoffs definitely increase because he is a guy that you know has scored 30 goals before.
Yeah, and 30 goal scorers, you know, whatever you might think of them, and he had 28 last year in only 70 games, so he would be a 30-goal scorer if he had stayed healthy. They don't grow on trees in this day and age in the NHL.
No, and Evander Kane did take it to the next level because, remember, he did, you know, as was talking about, he played hurt for a while, and then he really was one of the top point producers on a Buffalo team that wasn't exactly an upper echelon team last season, or this past season. So, you know, there's no question that Evander Kane's an interesting name, especially if he goes to the West Coast. Well, that means we'll see him more in Winnipeg than we do the one time a year when Buffalo comes to town. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even some of the, like, some of the names, I wonder how they get these names. You know, like, they've got, for the Jets, they've got Andrew Kopp and Joel Armia on this list. You know, I don't know that those guys are necessarily on the trading block, but for some reason they've managed to make their way, maybe because they're seen as guys who could potentially be expendable within the, you know, the expansion draft. So that's the reason why. But I just think it's funny because it's like, when you hear this trade list, you think, well, that means someone's talking about moving them. And you know, again, I think, like, Kopp is versatile, Army is versatile, but I don't know that they're in the same vein as, obviously, the Evander Canes or the...
And I guess from the Jets' perspective, you know, maybe you trade one of those players if you know Vegas is going to take them, right? So maybe, you know, Joel Armia, maybe you can get a second-round, third-round pick for him?
The problem with that, though, of course, is that a team has to value that guy enough to
sure.
want to acquire him and then presumably protect him.
Right. Even though this is a quote-unquote bad draft year, even though I think that has been overblown a little bit, I think there still are some really good players in this draft, even though 2015 and 2016 were, by all accounts, stronger draft years. I still don't think teams will trade second-round picks freely
no.
for players that they don't think can really contribute to their lineup. So a guy like Joel Armia, guys, I'll be honest, when Joel Armia first came over, I didn't have a lot of expectations, but the way he played last year, he's a very valuable player. So, I mean, the Jets, I don't think, want to lose him, but it goes back to what we were talking about last segment. You are going to lose someone. So whether it's Matthew Perreault, Joel Armia, Andrew Kopp, Toby Enstrom, somebody, right? Pick anybody who you think might be exposed, and they're going to get selected. So, I mean, there are going to be trades here, and, you know, a lot of the players on this list are guys that could be potentially exposed in the expansion draft.
Well, I think the Minnesota Wild are a fascinating case.
Well, Jonas Brodin, Drew, sorry to cut you off there. Jonas Brodin is a very interesting case because he's an excellent defenseman.
He's only 23 years old.
And, yeah, you'd think he's 26 or 27 because he's been in the league for a little bit now. But, I mean, the Minnesota Wild obviously lost in the first round, a huge disappointment for them because they were so good in the regular season. But a guy like Jonas Brodin is a huge part of that decor, right? Ryan Suter obviously leads that defense, and then you've got guys like Marco Scandella and Jared Spurgeon. But a guy like Matthew Dumba, I think, has really improved. I think he still has to improve more to become an elite top four defenseman, but he's certainly improved his game, taking less chances. But a guy like Jonas Brodin, you wonder, are they going to move him because a guy like Nino Niederreiter might have to be exposed if they don't re-sign him, right?
Yeah, well, then that's the problem. I mean, the Minnesota Wild are one of those teams that, you know, have a glut of players with no move clauses that they, you know, unless they can get some of those guys to waive them, you know, Jason Pominville with a no move clause at $5.6 million right now is saddling them with some significant problems.
Right, and Minnesota would love for Vegas to select him, but we don't know, again, if he's waiving his no-move clause.
Right, and Vegas isn't probably going to take a 34-year-old guy who makes almost $6 million.
Well, the only thing, though, is I'm not saying necessarily they do select Pominville, but they will have to select players that have, let's say, less than favorable cap hits, right? Because they have to get to the floor. So that could be a guy like Scott Hartnell. It could be a guy like Jason Pominville. They will have some of those quote-unquote bad contracts.
Sure.
But a guy like Pominville, certainly, I mean, the Wild would rather lose him than Brodin.
Yes.
They wouldn't lose Brodin. They would trade Brodin, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
I think they'd rather keep Brodin.
Well,
it's a good defenseman.
Well, they have the problem is they have four guys with no move clauses. You know, Parisi, Koivu, Pominville, they each have no move clauses up front. They got Suter on the back end with a no move clause. So are you going to go? They seem like the team that would have to go, you know, eight skaters and a goalie as opposed to the seven forwards, 3D and a goalie. And then all of a sudden, if you go eight skaters and you protect Brodin and you protect Dumba and you protect either Spurgeon or Scandella, all of a sudden, like you said, is he Jason Zucker? Are you going to lose Jason Zucker? Are you going to lose a guy like Nito Niederreiter? Are you going to lose a guy like, I mean, they got so many moving parts there.
Right, and you know Mikael Granlund is going to probably sign a 6 or 7 year deal, right?
Well, yeah, that's another guy, but you have to protect him again.
Right.
So then you're going to lose somebody else. So yeah. That's why the Wild are sort of an interesting test case to monitor as we approach the expansion draft. And of course, the names of the expansion draft, the list will be released next Saturday. Unfortunately, after we're off air, I think it's next Saturday at 5 o'clock is when the list has to be submitted. And then the expansion draft, of course, is the following Wednesday. So a lot of moving parts still in the air as we approach the NHL expansion draft and expect the trade market to heat up.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun next couple of weeks.
Fingers crossed.
Yep.
Fingers crossed. It's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
What Ken King said was, we're not going to make a threat to move. We're just going to move. We don't get the deal we need. And you're saying that's fine. Well, you just said Murray Edwards should pay for the building himself. The math works fine. They figured out public money is useful toward rejuvenating downtown and making a statement and keeping jobs. But we're smarter than that here. They figured it out in Manitoba, but we're smarter in Alberta. Taxpayers all over Canada have figured this out. Municipalities all over Canada have figured this out. Most intelligent people get this.
Brian Burke of the Calgary Flames, president of hockey operations, deciding to throw a little gasoline on a simmering fire earlier in the week. I believe that was Wednesday in Calgary. I don't like Brian Burke.
What?
I think Brian Burke is a blowhard of blowhards.
I love Brian
Takes
Burke.
Takes one to
know
one.
Fair enough, Dave. I can accept that comment. I thought Brian Burke looked like an ass on Wednesday night. Now, it might have been deliberate. They might have been playing between him and Ken King of the Calgary Flames, who came out and disowned, you know, Brian Burke's comments. They might have been playing a good cop, bad cop routine. But I think Brian Burke looked like an ass on Wednesday in Calgary with his comments to the Calgary, I think it was the Board of Trade or the Chamber of Commerce, when it came to the team, and we're just going to move if the public funding isn't made available to the Calgary Flames.
I think Brian Burke is a very good lawyer, and I think he understands leverage, and I think he understands negotiations, to be honest with you. And I think it was just a tactic. I think it's a fairly standard tactic. It's not shocking
mm-hmm.
by any stretch of the imagination. You know, and folks in this town are very familiar with the concept of, you know, build it or we will move. And then, of course, it literally happened. But or didn't happen and then did happen. But the fact is that it's not that surprising. I know that Ken King originally, back when he was having negotiations with the – or not negotiations, but conversations with the season ticket holders, the season ticket base, said that they weren't really going to try and use that sort of leverage.
He said we wouldn't threaten to leave.
Right. And so – but, I mean, you know, that and that's fine. And Brian Burke is Brian Burke, and he's talking about it now. I think from a taxpayer standpoint, you know, it's all well and good to talk in these terms and say, you know, he points to other situations and says, well, they did it, but we're smarter in Alberta. Now, the truth is, Alberta, as everyone knows, it's not the flush, rah-rah days that it was a few years back. The market's a little bit more strapped. Now, I'm not saying that they still don't have funds there, but the fact is, and
There's
a downturn in oil, but they're obviously able to get something done in Edmonton. So Calgary's saying, well, look, we've got one of the oldest buildings in the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do something. Now I think if what's reasonable is if you're asking the taxpayers to step up and sort of take on this responsibility for what amounts to billionaire private investors, then you have to say, provide them with the information. You can't just say you have to do this or else. If you're prepared to provide them with a plan, you're going to say, okay, well, this is what's going to happen to the market as a result of this. The market's going to see construction's going to go up, and this is going to go up. Now, the truth is, if those construction companies are owned, obviously they employ thousands of people, but if they're owned by, I guess it doesn't matter who owns them, but the idea is you have to be able to show the cost-benefit analysis to the taxpayers and prove it to them. And then I don't know if it needs to get to the point of creating some sort of referendum in Calgary, but the fact is you're asking these people to take on a major financial burden in a tough market, and you need to prove the value. Because right now the Calgary Flames are there. They're in a building that works. And now maybe it doesn't work for the hockey team, but the hockey team's a private entity. So why should I, as Joe Citizen, who makes $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, look at you and say, well, I'm going to subsidize your initiative. Now, maybe if you can prove to me that as Joe Citizen, I will have a benefit that's over and above, just the Calgary Flames staying in the city and the ownership enriching itself, then that's fine. Then make that argument. But if you can't just have this strongman argument and say, we're going to leave unless you build it, you have to massage this tax base. Because the truth is, you're not just asking let's say if they make an 18,000-seat arena, you're not going to be asking those 18,000-season ticket holders. You're asking hundreds of thousands of Calgarians to come up with the money for your building. So prove it to them. Make it worthwhile that it's a joint venture, and then maybe you'll have the agreement that it's something that needs to be done.
And Dave mentioned it. I mean, the oil industry has obviously been struggling, not just for the last 6 months or 12 months. It's been several years now. And the Calgary economy has been struggling, so the timing isn't very good. But to Dave's point, it has to be a partnership between the Calgary Flames organization and the city of Calgary, Drew, and the province of Alberta, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you get it done, a combination of private money and public money. But you're right, Dave, the argument about whether or not taxpayer dollars should be used for sports facilities, I mean, that's a long argument that we could talk about here for hours. But the point is that Brian Burke really chose the wrong avenue, I feel, to say this. And he's entitled to. He's the president of the team. But when you talk about, Calgarians who don't have jobs and all of that, and you're saying that, if we don't get that taxpayer money, we're leaving. First off, does anybody actually believe the Calgary Flames are leaving?
Absolutely
the Calgary
not.
Flames are not going anywhere. No, I think they will get an arena eventually, but I don't think it's going to happen in the next year. I think it's probably going to be maybe 3 to 5 years before they have another arena. And in the meantime, yes, they're playing in an older Saddle Dome. But, I mean, we've all been to the Saddle Dome. The Saddle Dome is a great arena. Is it antiquated? Yeah. But the reality is putting up an arena, and especially with the surrounding district, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Jets have it with the True North Square and the Shed, and Edmonton has that ice district. I mean, the model and, in L.A., and, we saw that in Philly with Xfinity Live and everything
that.
So the model is pretty clear, but it takes time to get this done. But to Dave's point, I mean, it doesn't just happen at the expense of taxpayers.
Yeah, and the other thing I was going to point out and in terms of like ownership and or people in the executive and strong-arm tactics, does anybody remember Mary Lemieux's trip to Kansas City?
Sure.
To check out the fancy arena? And that
remember
was just,
the Oilers did the same thing.
Of course.
The Oilers, remember, they God forbid, they used Wayne Gretzky to try and leverage the city of Edmonton to get an arena and went and did an exploratory visit. I can't remember if it was Seattle they went to or this is, going back maybe five mm-hmm. years ago before the new arena was built there. But, this is all part of the playbook. You're absolutely right. I just think that I thought that there's a way to go through the playbook. And I thought that Burke took it to the next level on Wednesday. And, he's sitting in a room of powerful, wealthy people. And those people aren't going to be intimidated by Brian Burke and his bluster. I mean, you saw the back and forth where he's lecturing the fan who asked him the question. Not the fan. He's lecturing the businessman who's in attendance at the Chamber of Commerce luncheon or whatever. And the guy's not going to be intimidated by Brian Burke.
Well, Brian Burke's also not going to be intimidated by those people because Brian Burke, you remember, he worked for the NHL,
yeah.
So he reported to the Board of Governors,
yeah, yeah.
And he reports to Murray Edwards, a billionaire.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like he's uncomfortable in that situation either.
I'm not
saying what Brian Burke said was right, because I think it was wrong. To threaten the team moving to Quebec, I think, is ridiculous.
Well, I don't even think
it's not happening.
Yeah, I agree. Like, nobody believes that the Flames are going anywhere, and ultimately, they will come to some sort of agreement, but the initial plan that they unveiled was $890 million. I mean, it just How about you just focus on one thing at a time? Build the arena. Get the arena built. And I mean, an arena doesn't cost $890 million nowadays. So, you know, figure out the arena, and then, you know, you can deal with getting a shed district or a True North Square or the ice area in Edmonton, whatever it is. You know, bite-sized chunks. Go with that approach rather than shooting for the moon and then looking like a bit of a jackass when the city of Calgary comes back and says, well, you know, we're having some economic downturn. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of that, Mr. Billionaire Owner, but maybe this isn't the right time to ask for $890 million worth of a project.
And then I don't know if part of it is looking over or looking up at Edmonton and seeing that they have this bright, shiny new arena, arguably the nicest arena, according to, you know, people that I've talked to that have been there, Richie mainly. And it's a beautiful new arena. And, you know, you look at Edmonton going to the second round and you see the 12 Garth Brooks concerts that Edmonton had. Maybe there is a little inferiority complex.
Did they have 12 Garth Brooks concerts? Really?
And as he was at 11 of them.
Yeah, I didn't realize you're such a big Garth Brooks fan. There absolutely is. They look down the road at their northern cousins, you know, just not far. And they say they got their beautiful new arena. Why don't we have our beautiful new arena? I get it. But there's ways to play the game, and then there's ways to not play the game. And I thought Burke was a jackass on Wednesday.
Even though I love Brian Burke, I am going to agree with you on that one.
Well, I thought the comment from the fan in response, where Burke's lecturing him, most smart people can realize this, and then the guy says back to him, most smart people can tie a tie. You know, which I thought, again, everything about him rubs me the wrong way. You're in a, just don't wear a tie. Don't wear it around your neck like that. You're not a clown. And I know it shouldn't.
We're talking about a tie here. I mean, if he wants to wear his tie like that, whatever. I mean, I don't have a problem with the tie. I mean, as far as what he says,
I think it's disrespectful of the room that you're in. I think it's disrespectful of the room that you're in to show up looking like that. I do. I think I know I shouldn't even be bothered by it. And I know that it means absolutely nothing. But I think it is just, it reeks of arrogance and it reeks of disrespect to me.
Unfortunately,
and it doesn't cost you anything more to be respectful to the people you're talking
sure.
to.
Sure. Granted, you know, Brian Burke is a guy that marches to the beat of his own drum.
So be respectful. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that, Drew.
Quickly, before we move on, Seattle, it sounds like they have an agreement with some very high-powered players to get a renovation underway at the Key Arena. That's where, of course, the Seattle Supersonics used to play prior to them moving to Oklahoma City. If they get that underway and that gets done and they are able to modernize this new arena in Seattle, and they got Jerry Bruckheimer, and they got a minority owner of the Boston Celtics who's a billionaire and everything else. Does anybody think that the NHL doesn't expand to Seattle?
Right now it's looking like years down the road it could happen, but I mean, we're talking about what, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? They don't even have the arena built, but yes, it looks like the possibility of Seattle getting a team is greater.
Over,
but again, I think it's way too early to know, though. That's my own personal opinion.
You got to be thinking the folks in Quebec City sitting there with that shiny new arena, and that's perfectly equipped for to handle NHL.
And we know that,
and I understand the whole balance issue.
Yeah. Quebec is a much better candidate for relocation.
I think they're using Quebec as a stalking horse for relocation to their. And that's too bad for. That's unfortunate, because absolutely Quebec deserves deserves a team before a place like Seattle. But I think, you know, they're sitting there holding on to Quebec to see what happens with
and also the
Carolina
balance.
Hurricanes.
It's yeah, of course, I get it. But
and in the meantime, they've got the Quebec Remparts to watch.
In a beautiful, gorgeous new arena. But, you know, good for them anyways. Congratulations goes out to Melvin Harleton. He texted Bell Acres to 12-90-90 and has won 2 green fees to go play some golf at Bell Acres Golf and Country Club. Melvin will be in touch with you accordingly coming up via text over here. Again, if you want to reach us in studio at any point during the show, 12-90-90, text us here in studio. Standard messaging rates apply.
That a boy, Melvin.
There you go.
The Melvins, great band.
There you go. When we come back, we are going to be joined by James Patrick. He's, of course, from Winnipeg. He's the new head coach of the Kootenai Ice, and you may have heard of his nephew. He's likely to be drafted first or second overall at the upcoming 2017 NHL draft. James Patrick joins us next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 12-9.